Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos. He was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute, where he authored nearly 30 articles concerning financial reform, energy, and environment. He then joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implementing the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the permanent subcommittees on investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and the Governmental Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee, and is the author of a report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wallace Turberville.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
And what explains this turnaround in Detroit, where the pensioners were going to really take a haircut and only get this is the police and fire pensioners of the city of Detroit? They were only going to get pennies on the dollars, and the banks were going to largely be made whole. And I remember talking to you at the time, but it looks like you and others have intervened, and there's been quite a turnaround where the pensioners are going to get most of their pensions back. And I'm not sure about what's happening with the banks, but explain what's happening, if you can, Wallace Turberville.
Well, yes, it's a bit of a curiosity, actually, except that I think there is an explanation. I think that what one must view this as is an indication that the whole bankruptcy has been really part of a political process. The city of Detroit was taken over by an emergency manager appointed by the governor, and there are different parties in control of the state house and traditionally in the city of Detroit, so that at the outset of the whole episode, the situation that was really happening on the ground there in Detroit was skewed in terms of public relations by the emergency manager to, you know, some improve his credibility. He's not a democratically elected official, and in order to set the stage for negotiation. And I think that's one of the things we were able to point up when we did our report. The information was coming exclusively from the emergency manager at that time, and it was, I think, useful to have a critical analysis of that so that a better balanced description of what the situation was. They tried to say that the pensions were in much worse shape than they were, and they were trying to downplay the situation with the banks. So that sort of imbalance has been redressed a great deal in recent days.
So what is then the motives there? If you've got a fairly ideological Republican governor, and Detroit is the red state part of Detroit is the rural area, and the blue state are the urban areas, in particular Detroit. So it looks as if there's a real political game going on here, and the bankruptcy person that the governor hired seemed to have been, many people argued, in fact, that the whole bankruptcy of Detroit itself was unnecessary, that this was something that the governor forced on Detroit in effect for political reasons to punish this Democratic stronghold. Is there anything to that?
Well, I don't know what was his motive was, but one the opportunity that presented itself was to use a bankruptcy process where a lot of things can get changed to remake the political structure there, and it has a lot to do with public employee unions, which is one reason they were so aggressive in the first months with regard to the pensions, threatening huge cuts to pension benefits. And so the notion was that it was a crisis, but there was opportunity in the crisis to redo those things and change some of the balance of power with regard to public employees. And that just simply couldn't hold water. There's an election this coming autumn where the governor's up. So I think what happened is that some of the political forces sort of rebalanced over time. Now, the question whether bankruptcy was the solution to the city is a really interesting one. I think it's fair to say that the whole thing could have been handled differently with cooperation and sort of constructive cooperation from the state government. Perhaps no bankruptcy, certainly maintaining a democratically elected government in the city could have, even if they went through bankruptcy, would have made things more legitimate, if you will, for the people of Detroit. And so whichever way they went, whether it was a sort of a readjustment of things through a constructive engagement between the city and the state, or in fact even a bankruptcy filing, if that was the way it went, would have worked out better. The whole process has been really something. They're up to $100 million of expenses that legal expenses and consulting fees and all the rest that the city's gone through because of this arduous process. So, several different possible outcomes, but I guess that in the final analysis, since the sort of the forces of good common sense and doing the right thing have sort of rebalanced, at least the outcome is much better than it would have been.
Well, it's worth noting for the audience, Wallace Turberville, you know, the mayor of Detroit, who made all these shaky and shady deals with Wall Street just before the crash, he's in jail, of course. And the banker who made the deal, who was with the city, who made the deal, is now working for one of the banks. So there's a reasons to be sort of skeptical about that. But where did in this new realignment, where the pensioners are going to be largely made whole, and presumably the banks who were previously going to be made whole at the expense of the pensioners will be getting less. How do they manage to find some extra money here? And they've been able to save the collection at the Detroit Institute of Art and adding more than $800 million to the pensions with money from charitable foundations and the state, which is yet to approve these funds. So we're not out of the woods, are we?
We're not, because the money from the charitable trusts is contingent on the state making a contribution. And the governor said he would do that, but it has to pass through the legislature. So it's not like this is in the can, as it were. Things have to fall in place for it all to work. But one must credit the bankruptcy judge, Judge Rhodes, who did several things. There was a big derivatives transaction that the emergency manager tried to settle for a large sum of money instead of really challenging, and the judge wouldn't let him do that. Kept sending him back for more and more negotiation. The judge, Judge Rhodes, and his associates, Judge Rosen, were instrumental in working with these charitable trusts to get them involved. So the judges themselves, the judiciary has been, while not perfect, have really been very constructive in how they approach things and haven't simply taken what the emergency manager wanted and just implemented it. They've been very very activist and in many respects in a very positive way for the city. So one must give them credit, too, for getting beyond sort of a more passive approach to what their job was, to be more active and involved to try to make this thing come out right.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to mention, of course, you'll be speaking at the UCLA Hammer Forum coming up a week from Thursday, May the 1st at 7:30 p.m., which I'll be hosting, From Wall Street to Main Street, A Case for Community Banking. Now, why is it that the U.S. is unique amongst the advanced democracies of not having an infrastructure bank, a public infrastructure bank, which would have certainly helped in this case with Detroit, and why there are so few community banks, except for, say, the Bank of North Dakota?
Well, there's been a tremendous concentration of in the financial sector that's occurred over the last 30, 35 years. We elected to move in the direction of deregulation and, of course, the elimination of Glass-Steagall, which separated investment banking and commercial banking, which has caused the two together has caused this huge concentration of capital and power in a relatively small number of banks, and has given us a situation where these banks are no longer responsive to the needs of state and local regions or even small business. So things have gotten very, very big and very, very concentrated, actually very, very profitable for the big banks. But we have a hard time deciding to direct capital towards things like infrastructure, frankly, things like education, certainly addressing climate change. And it has a lot to do with income disparity as well, as it turns out. So the fact of the matter is some move toward decentralizing the way the financial sector works would be very good for the public and certainly very good for state and local governments who are really on the front line. They're sort of the first responders for some of these requirements that take long, you know, it's long-term investment as opposed to very short-term investment, trading decisions, high-frequency trading, that sort of thing. So we've wandered away from that for a few decades now, and the time is more than right to try to think about how ways to reverse that, and state banks, community banks are a good way to do that.
So what's your sense just in the last minute of whether or not we're heading in that direction, that there's a move afoot out there to change, to help Main Street and not reward Wall Street?
Well, there's a lot of talk about it. I'm afraid that there's less less activity than there should be. So the event that we're going to be at is a good forum for trying to move that conversation along. I think that at some point we have to, as a nation, figure out how to make good long-term decisions, and that's just that it comes down to that. And
sure.
if we don't move it along, we've got problems that will just keep snowballing. So I don't think we have much choice,
sure.
but I think we'd all be served by moving along in a practical way much, much, much more effectively.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Wallace Turberville, again, the senior
fellow. I enjoyed it.
Again, thank you, Wallace, again, the senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs for 12 years. He's also testified before the permanent subcommittees at the U.S. Senate and the House Financial Services Committee, and is the author of a report at Demos, The Detroit Bankruptcy. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'll be back again tomorrow. Bye for now. Singing something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and this land here under.